Hi, welcome to Inside Learning episode 124 for the 7th of November 2013. Much ado about, well, 19 things actually.
Matthew and Bill, it's great to talk to both of you at the same time again.
Hi there, Steve. Hi, Bill.
Hi, guys. Good to talk to you again. Good to be back.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you back, Bill. We've really missed your erudition and wit on the programme and your insights.
Yeah. Mm. We've been keen to expand the kind of regular guests and you know, central kind of cast of the podcast. So this is really exciting. Good man, Bill.
I don't know if I can promise you erudition, but yeah, I've got one or two sick little things to talk about, I think.
Well, I say, given the gap since we last spoke to you, I'm sure you must have some stories that, you know, in the world of literacy that you can begin the podcast with. So where would you like to start, Bill? I'll give the as Matthew so elegantly put it, I'm doing the cherry thing tonight. So let's give the floor to you first.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I mean, I think you said the critical word there, Steve. Stories, and for me, it's about stories. The whole sort of thing about literature really is it's about stories and narrative and about how we create them and how we co-create them and so on. And I think it was Christopher Booker, the guy who wrote the Seven Basic Plots book, who said this is, and I paraphrase obviously, this is the way we explain the world to ourselves and to each other. And if education isn't about explaining the world to ourselves and each other, then I don't know what it is. But I'll kick you off with a personal story, because last week I apologised. I was due to be on the podcast last week, and I apologised because I had to go to my grandmother's funeral. And for those people out there who know me and have met me, they'll be gasping right now that I actually had a surviving grandmother until a couple of weeks ago. It is quite amazing, really. But my granny Boyd, as she was universally known, was 96. And until 2 or 3 months ago, I think we kind of assumed that, you know, there was nothing else but she would survive beyond 100, because she was just that kind of person.
That's on your mantelpiece for the telegram.
Absolutely, yeah. Unfortunately, she didn't, but what an incredible... I mean, not so much a woman as an institution, really. We were actually totting up the number of offspring that she had. And my father was the eldest of four brothers. My father sadly died almost 30 years ago now, but he was the eldest of four brothers. So from sons to grandchildren to great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren, we reckon there's something like a total of 75 or thereabouts.
Wow.
So this was not so much a family as a kind of major organisation.
You're in Taunton.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she was an amazing character, Granny. Really, she was one of nine children, and born and raised on a farm, and moved around, went into service as a young girl, as many young women did in these days, working, you know, for some kind of wealthier family in rural Ayrshire somewhere. But her husband, my grandfather, died when he was 41. So she was basically bringing up these four strapping young men on her own, which she did admirably. And she was an elder of the church for goodness knows how many years. She was a keen golfer. She got a new set of golf clubs for her 80th birthday. She played bridge regularly until a couple of months ago, and mentally. She was. I didn't visit her as often as I should have done, but on occasions when I did visit her, she updated me on every news item, everything that had happened in the town incidentally of Maybole, which is just a few miles south of here. She just updated me on everything that had happened since the last time I spoke to her, including births, deaths, and marriages, of course. So a remarkable woman, and as demonstrated by the turnout at her funeral service, first of all in the church, and then at the local crematorium. So she taught me. I mean, she taught me, among other things, my debating skills, because she liked nothing better than a debate stroke discussion, and that's where I learned really to hold my own in a debate, if you like. And even although I turned out to be an avowed atheist, and she was an elder of the church, we had some fantastic discussions.
Wow!
So that was Granny Boyd.
Great loss for your family and yourself.
Well, it is, but great memories as well, of course. And it's a bit of a cliche, but when people get to 96, you think, well, she's had a good full life, you know.
Yeah, yeah. A good innings. We use that phrase in Scotland.
A good innings, as they say.
I barely know the sports it refers to.
I was going to say, does that travels north of the border, does it?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Very much so. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was interesting to say about debating skills and. Was there any link to the traditions of the churches? I was just thinking about the ancient art of rhetoric, which was, you know, considered the liberal art in classical times, wasn't it? Now, I wonder if that came down through the tradition of the church.
I don't know whether that came to her from the tradition of the church, Steve, to be honest, or whether she just had that anyway and kind of took it to the church with her. because she used to, until recently, again, she would tell us stories of her Kirk session meetings. Is that the right expression? Church of Scotland session meetings, where the elders of the church discuss the various matters. And she would, she spoke her mind. She would, if she didn't like what the minister was doing, then she would say that. And I think they had in her particular church. Maybe this is a feature of all churches nowadays, but I reckon they must have had at least 10 ministers in her church in the time that she was there.
I suppose, Steve, there was a real Scots working class debate kind of tradition. So you're never quite sure where that kind of tendency comes from in a working class Scot.
Yeah, sure.
I think it was also just part of sort of working class ethos, if you like. You know, the notion that an education, as much as you could find it or afford it or whatever, was something to be valued.
It was strongly associated with the the growth of the socialist movement in Scotland, wasn't it? You know, I mean, Keir Hardie, you know, and that kind of time. You know, the contemporaries of him politically, you know, we're very much about working classes raising themselves through knowledge. So it was a strong permeating culture, Steve. I'm no expert on it, but difficult one to just
name
and a place on.
No, just think, I was just thinking about the parallels with one of my grandparents, you know, that they were a Methodist family, but I remember my grandma sitting me down saying, yeah, we've always voted Labour, you know, we're kind of a socialist family. And again, had a very strong sort of Methodist tradition, but also a very strong tradition of talking about current affairs and the power of education. In fact, my grandfather went on to become a primary head teacher way back when. But so it was interesting parallels there.
Yeah, definitely.
And of course, the first state schools were church schools. Going back to the church connection again.
Yeah. You're right. They are quite synonymous, actually, aren't they? Yeah. Many of them were in Ayrshire as well, of course, were they not?
Absolutely, yeah. The heart of all learning.
Well, thank you, Bill. That was a really interesting personal story to begin the cast with and kind of also to start us reflecting. So, moving on, Matthew, have you got sort of something more?
Yeah.
You tickled your fancy.
Tickled my fancy, yes. I just wanted to highlight a story that's an old one. It comes from a kind of a modern tendency I've noticed for a study to be released about 14 times before the last piece of data has been wrung from it. You know, is it just me or have you noticed that? It's another one about the use of mobile devices, iPads in particular. It's from the Hull study, and specifically by Kevin Burden and Trevor Mayle. And they've been looking at four schools in Edinburgh, where they've been going for one-on-one iPad learning. I believe there's been some use of the little netbook devices as well. And they've got some pretty good data out of this, and an increasing, you know, emerging picture that the learning advantages of giving children one-to-one independent wireless devices is becoming clearer. You know, it's yet another piece of data that's just adding to a strong trend, I think, even when you correct for the excitement of new devices. And what they've highlighted in their comments on the study are that children get far more realistic learning settings. It's something I hadn't really thought about, that teachers are learning now to set tasks for youngsters that are less about from the textbook or something that's kind of made up from teachers' best guess at real world experience, but you can now pretty much, you know, get in and about the real world, you know. So if young people are doing a task to design a travel, you know, a travel task or something like that, you know, or a travel brochure or whatever, they go online and they look examples, and you know, and the, you know, the benchmark isn't the teacher's you know, grade criteria or whatever. The benchmark increasingly becomes what the real world has as its best examples. And I thought that was a really, really nice point. Also, that simultaneous to this, Edinburgh is obviously a big city centre area. The two secondaries are Forrester and Forrester and Grace Mountain High. Funnily enough, I've actually visited both of those as a guest speaker, so I know them at least from distant memory. Sheens and Broomhouse Primary. But the study indicated that 25% of youngsters regularly used school computers, but 35% of them regularly used their mobile devices, such as smartphones, which is why I'm saying it's a city setting. This, it might not be true everywhere else. So in actual fact, teachers are now just responding to a trend that's becoming deeply embedded, that, you know, youngsters are already wanting to do this with their increasingly sophisticated smartphones anyway. So they were really clear on the independent learning that's coming out of it, and that example was given of a child who's now writing way better, having had difficulties because the slowness of using the pencil and paper is taken out of the equation, and actually typing on the, you know, the iPad keyboard seems to be a, you know, a way of connecting the ideas to the, you know, to the narrative, Bill, if you like, to pick up your thread a little better. I can just see our friend Anne and Glady at this moment smashing something in fury. And
good old Anne.
Out in the islands.
No, I'm sure she isn't. I'm sure she isn't, actually.
No, I'm sure she is, but she'll forgive us. So there is that. And it goes on to talk about Edinburgh having 6,500 iPads at the moment, but they've got 44,000 students. The council, as a result, presumably, of the good experiences they're having here, have done something interesting. They're promising to match fund any money that secondary schools put towards funding entire year groups with iPads. I can just see some benefactor coming and calling the council's bluff. I know from, you know, some experience of working in local councils now that if someone was to come along and say, right, we'll do it for every school if the council matches it, we may not actually be ready for that.
Yes.
Financial blow. But I think the summary here is that you know, the world's moving fast to online. We keep saying it's changed, it's moving fast. I think there's an argument that the online world has plateaued for a while. You know, the benefits of it are probably similar now to what they were 4 years ago. It's just now about getting people more access to it, and teachers now seeing the benefits of it. So,
does it say anything there, Matthew, about the role of the teacher? You mentioned about criteria. I mean, so take the example you posed about going on online and looking at, you know, real life examples, but how do you then evaluate which are the best of those examples? Do you sort of mean it's not just a question of looking at examples, is it, and seeking information? Sometimes there has to be some sort of evaluative criteria in there.
It doesn't discuss that at all in this article.
But which is one of the things is one of the things that worries me, because it, in a sense, that people say, oh yeah, aren't iPads and mobile technology great and everyone's using them? But, you know, there is a real there is a quality issue, isn't there? There, you know, therefore, what's the role? How does the teacher intervene in that?
Got an interesting point there, Steve, because one of my seven reading strategies, if you like, which is something I kind of tour around the country, and I'm doing a presentation on them tomorrow again in West Lothian. The last of the seven reading strategies is evaluation, and the whole thing about the strategy, if strategy is in fact the right word, but the whole thing about that element of reading is about the ability to make evaluations about text, whatever the text in the broadest sense. And I guess that's what you're talking about there. But the key thing for me is when you ask that question, what's in my head is, are we teaching kids to evaluate what they're finding there? Not how are we as teachers evaluating what was found there, but how are we preparing the learners to evaluate what they're finding. That's the key element, and it's actually a central outcome of Curriculum for Excellence, that ability. So that's where we're going, and for me the whole thing about iPads, mobile, digital technology is we shouldn't even waste our time discussing now whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. It's a fact. It's the world we're living in. It's about how we prepare people to use these things critically is, for me, what is important, not whether we should use them at all. I mean, that's now almost a nonsense discussion.
Yeah, I agree with you. Although it's interesting how often you hear the discussion being held, you know, and that
of course
educators will come forward and say they're getting in the way, they're a side issue. You know, I do think we should be moving beyond that now. Certainly, we can't necessarily afford them. That's a problem now as to, you know, equity issues. But yeah, you're right. It's the growing methodologies. Certainly, some of the good stuff I've seen being done with them is still around flipping the classroom, or cooperative learning kind of approaches when you're, you know, setting teams to find and evaluate data, and therefore building in that, you know, sense of teaching the evaluation, and then, you know, producing outcomes and products with it, often using the same devices.
But it's also interesting, Matthew. It's also interesting you say that kids are now, instead of textbooks, are accessing the real thing or the real world. But of course, it's the virtual real world. It's not the actual real world. Yeah. I think it's important to keep that in mind as well. That it's still kids still do need to access the real world as well for balance. But I mean, that's almost a given. That's just makes so much sense, I guess. Or is it a given?
Well,
so we're not doing, you know, Olympic sport 2012 then online as 2 hours PE for Scotland then, no?
I would hope not.
Pity that could have kept costs down.
We do a virtual Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, is it? Yeah. So that's interesting pedagogical story. Bill, later in the program, you wrote something there about the seven reading strategies. We're going to come back and ask you more about that later on, I think, because that sounds, you've opened a fascinating line of inquiry there. So if you don't mind.
I think Bill was going to do something about Alfie Cohen's. Was it 10 teaching strategies?
Yeah, there's a thing.
Yeah, well,
if we play a game, we could get 17 things out of this.
Is that what I was going to say? Seven really.
17 strategies.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll come back to that and perhaps devote a bit more of the program time to that. I just quickly wanted to bring something up. I don't normally flop in front of the telly, but on Monday night I felt really floppy. I just turned the telly on and I watched the choir sing while you work with Gareth Malone. I don't know if you've heard of this guy, but I was just I was really absorbed by it. I really enjoyed it. As I said, I don't normally watch telly, but and I was thinking about the pedagogical, the teaching lessons of it. I really touched this guy, and I thought there was a number of lessons I extracted. I mean, first of all, the guy's obviously extremely knowledgeable and he's an expert, you know, number one. He's obviously very passionate about the whole thing about getting, so he's going into workplaces, just to people who've not seen it, he's going into workplaces, he's chosen five of Britain's biggest workplaces and he's visiting one each week there, and getting people to sing in a choir, and then there's going to be a contest and they're going to have best workplace choir, you know, but leaving that aside. So he goes, he's obviously an expert, he's obviously passionate, so there's kind of a lesson there. But when he goes in to talk to people, I mean, he does a number of things. He gets them together. He gives them the big picture. He gives them a kind of emotional feel about the songs they're singing and what the songs are trying to convey, and a feel for the thing. And then he goes into the sort of detail of it, and he kind of matches people to you know to their kind of, if you like, dispositions or talents for certain parts. And then he gives some really honest feedback. He says, "Yeah, this is not good enough. You know, you're singing sharp. You should be, you know, what have you." But he also really encouraging. He's really upbeat about them as well. Well, you know, we can do this. And I was thinking, it was a brilliant kind of example of a really good pedagogical process. You know, when you put all the things in the mix, you know, starting with the passionate expert who gives people a real kind of emotional big picture about why they should do it and what the thing's about, but also breaks it down into detail, matches people to the sequences, and then gives them really, really kind of focused feedback. And I thought, you know, they had a part of the thing is getting people from across the company. So it was working with P&O, this ferry company. So you've got guys who are on the ships to people in the back office who never see a ship, you know, to people in Calais and what have you. And so as part is bringing people together. And you think, you know, you listen to something, you think, oh, we're never going to sing, you know. But they just produce a beautiful result. I just thought it was a great kind of metaphor for a teaching process. So,
yeah. I have seen it. I saw it. I think it must have been quite a bit of the last series. But that particular one, Steve, the P&O one, I actually saw it. I think I must have seen the repeat because it was quite late just the other night when it happened to come on. I was watching a news program or something and it came on, and I ended up actually involved in it. You know, I hadn't intended to, but you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. He's got a terrific kind of approach to it. And I think you're right about that passionate expert thing about him. And when you think back, certainly when I think back to teachers who influenced and inspired me at school, that's exactly what they were. They were passionate experts. They had a love for what they did and what they were trying to get across and so on. And I don't know whether that notion has kind of fallen out of favour a bit in recent years, or whether passionate expert became a bit of self-centered show-off or something in the sort of the public psyche. But there's definitely a lot to be said for it, I think. I mean, certainly in his case, it just comes across his absolute love for the music.
Yeah,
and you're right. He is. I mean, he is quite. The feedback is quite to the point, and you know, he doesn't pull any punches. But at the same time, there's people who are definitely left with a feeling that he wants to involve everybody in the team.
Yeah,
and I think that's a crucial part of it as well.
Yeah, the other thing that struck me as well, which I forgot to mention, was the other kind of element was the discipline. You know, actually, this is going to be hard work, people. You know. And if you don't want to be part of it, then fair enough. But, you know, but the sense that actually to master something, you do have to be disciplined.
Yeah. Yeah. And he expects them to have done quite a bit of work by the time he visits again.
Yeah. 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 That's right. So there's a kind of that rehearsal element. Yeah. So I just thought, yeah, it's fascinating kind of a general metaphor for good teaching practice, I suppose.
Mm. Can this still be seen on iPlayer then for someone like me who hasn't seen it?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. BBC program.
Yeah, yeah. BBC Two on Monday night. Yeah.
Okay, no, it sounds good. Sorry, I haven't seen it.
Actually, if I could just bring in a brief, very quickly there, because actually while we're on the theme, there was a report produced. I think Teach First, you know, the kind of master's program in England for highly qualified teachers. We've talked about Teach First before. I think they've done a report somewhere which surveyed a large number of young people. And one of the things that came out of this was what young people thought of, you know, schools are about and their teachers. Apart from the thing that they felt teachers need to be better at discipline, you know, that the young people were getting in the way, the misbehaving students were getting in the way of the learning. I think there was a huge number of the young people in the survey said that actually what they really related to was teachers who were passionate about this subject. Sorry, I was just linking that story.
I think that's a really good link. And as you were talking about this, Gareth Bloke, if I got the name right, I was just realizing just how, you know, how much I too loved the passionate teachers, you know, and but I'm just wondering how hard is it for a teacher to keep that passion if you're teaching 20 years?
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking of the secondary teacher perhaps is doing a subject with an expertise and 20 years in, you know, five periods a day, you know. Some of them do seem to manage it, but you know, how?
I think it also comes back to the notion of the learning teacher, you know, the teacher who's a learner first and continues to learn. I was an English teacher for 30 years or thereabouts. And I have to say, I knew a significant number of English teachers who didn't read much, which I think is quite
odd.
I think odd is the word. Yeah, I find that quite
odd. Yeah. I know. I remember doing one of your department used to sponsor these courses when you were teaching for things that you were interested in the good old days when money was floating around for teachers. You could go on a term course, and I did one on drama. And I always remember the drama who was a really kind of passionate teacher. He said, I'm just amazed at how many English teachers don't read poetry. You know, how many English teachers here read poetry? You know, kind of one hand went up.
That's really amazing, isn't it? Because I don't know many people at all who'd read poetry, and yet we still put it front and centre in the curriculum, don't we? Or I presume we do. I haven't studied English.
It's kind of well in there, yeah. It's not a common pursuit, but
then again,
if we only had what everybody does in the curriculum, it would be a pretty narrow curriculum, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but the point that leaps unbidden to mind here is you don't get Billy Connolly and others having a go in their comedy routine. Who the hell ever found any use for their owl and the bloody pussycat? It's always who ever found a use for the Pythagoras, you know? Actually, very few of us do the poetry stuff.
Actually, it's funny you should mention Pythagoras, because one of the more interesting books I've been reading recently is actually a book on numeracy. It's called Thinking in Numbers by a guy called Daniel Tammet, which I'll bore you with if you like.
Please go on.
Yeah, well, no, it's I occasionally do some work with a fellow called Tom Rennick. I don't know whether you know Tom of Maths on Track. Tom's an ex-math teacher, now a numeracy consultant, I suppose. So we've been developing this connection, if you like, between literacy and numeracy, which is quite fascinating and is fascinating us more and more as we look at it, including trying to apply the 7 reading strategies to numeracy, which we think we're doing remarkably well, but then we would think that. But anyway, I picked up this book called Thinking in Numbers by Daniel Tammet, who's an autistic savant. Mm-hmm. I must confess I'd never heard of him before until I saw the book referenced somewhere. So I duly got the book and had a look at it, and it really is a fascinating read. This guy, for example, one of his fascinations is with pi, the number pi. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize until I read this how significant pi is. You know, everybody learns what pi is at school, and what is it, equals pi r squared? Yeah. Something equals pi r squared, doesn't it? Something significant.
The circumference of a circle.
That's the one, yeah. But I didn't quite realise the actual significance of pi, and people devote their lives to studying it. And apparently it goes to an infinite number of decimal places without repeating itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this guy, being an autistic savant and sort of obsessed with numbers, he learns pi, and apparently in 2004 he conducts this sort of televised performance, if you like, at Oxford University, whereby he recites, he learns and recites pi to 22,500 decimal places from memory. And it doesn't repeat itself. And it takes him 5 hours and 9 minutes to do it.
That's unbelievable.
Just an unthinkable achievement.
The only possible answer to that is it has to be simple, not difficult as a task.
Well, I mean, it's just a.
What,
it's just,
I mean, is the, well, it's just, whatever the algorithm just, is that he's using to compute this in his mind, it has to be simple because, you know, that's how computers do things. You know, he must be thinking and acting like a computer in this regard.
But simple is.
Yeah, I'm not belittling it, guys. You know,
simple is apparently what it isn't, because it's, as I say, it's, you know, it's just it's a random selection of numbers from nothing to nine, and they don't. There are no patterns in it. It doesn't repeat.
What is he? Has he memorized them?
He's memorized it. 22,500 decimal places. I mean, he's not entirely unique, because I think the previous record was not all that much short of 22,000 decimal places. But unthinkable.
It certainly starts to make a record like eating the most boiled eggs or something like that, you know, seem achievable, doesn't it?
Peeling to insignificance.
I'm peeling. Is that peeling to rather than peeling to?
Peeling to insignificance.
Oh dear. But, the depth of yolks will sink to, eh?
Oh no. Oh my goodness. But I'd recommend it, and it's a great example. The book itself is a great example of a combination of numbers and storytelling, if you like.
Okay, thereby
coming back to my my theory that everything reverts to being about story.
But I actually, and yes, can I make a link there as well? As a person who, you know, has a scientific and mathematical teaching background, although not very good at maths. I continue to bang on about this because it depresses me so much. You're saying you don't really know the importance of pi, you know, if you've only studied maths to a low level in school. And the reason is that it's that old rule again. We don't let the thick ones learn all the interesting things about stuff like pi, because there's a story about pi. There's a story about what it means for engineering. There's a story about what it means for quantum physics. There's a story of what it means for geometry. There's a story of what it means for imaginary numbers, and even they're linked to, you know, to parallel universes. There's a story of coincidence and magic in it, that lots of things that you work out backwards in terms of the, you know, the mathematical expression of what you find in nature magically finds to work when you put the factor of 3.14 in it.
Yeah,
that's a story, and that's exciting. But we don't tell it to the inverted commas thick ones, and that's wrong.
Well, actually, yeah, absolutely, Matthew. I mean, I have to say, I like to think that I was not one of the thick ones at school. I was actually when we were streamed in secondary school, I was actually in the A stream, and I did what was then 6 year studies maths, or what is now what's it called nowadays. Advanced higher, that's the word.
I'm picturing you with a big gold medallion on and, you know, and big rings on your knuckles shouting at people at the top of my tag. Was that the A stream you said there? Which one were you?
The A stream as opposed to team.
Sorry.
No, that was
Steve's gone a bit there, I think. Sorry, Steve.
Steve's gone. But you're right. I mean, and the thing is, we weren't. It took me.
Listeners won't know, we're actually seeing Steve on the Skype video here, and he's just gone.
But listen, I mean, how ridiculous is it that it took me until the ripe old age that I am now to read Daniel Tammet to actually understand the story of pi and the significance of it. We learned pi at school. We learned the circumference of a circle and all that, but we didn't. As you say, we weren't given the bigger picture. We weren't told of the significance of it, the story behind it, and so on. But I think that was just a feature of learning and teaching in schools then. And to be fair to teachers now, I'm quite sure it is different. I mean, Tom Rennick, that I mentioned earlier, for example, Tom prefaces a lot of what he says in our talks by saying, if I was teaching numeracy now, this is how I would teach this. Yeah. And it's not how we would have taught it 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. Bill, you've teased us with these seven reading strategies. I'm going to have to ask you to... we've had the last one. What are the first six?
Okay. I don't have them in front of me, so I'm going to have to do this.
Sorry.
But they're basically... The first one is making predictions. I mean, I should say about these strategies, they're in a sense, what I have in trying to make sense of the reading process, and I don't mean the learning to read process, the phonics and the learning the alphabet and all that. I mean the stage of developing fluent comprehending readers, that stage of that next stage, if you like, and how we adult sophisticated readers, how we operate, how we read, and how we take certain things for granted. But the processes are actually going on in the background, if you like. And the seven strategies are making predictions, asking questions of a text, that is, you know, questioning a text as you go through it, if you like. Making comparisons, you know, what does this remind me of? What's it like? Where have I seen this before? And so on. Or what is it, what else is there in my life or my experience that is resembling this? Making comparisons, recognizing patterns, absolutely crucial to developing reading skills and developing a whole load of other things. Daniel Tammet is very big on patterns, and obviously, when you look at learning numerical tables and so on, pattern plays a huge part in that. But if you think of language and reading and the number of patterns that have to be learned, patterns in terms of grammatical patterns, punctuation, if you think of reading text and looking at the at recurring images and so on.
Or recurring narratives that are just recurring. Anyone who's read any Chick Lit knows all about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Or that whole, oh my God, the guy she hated for the whole novel, they've got together in the end kind of thing, you know. The pattern.
So that's what I would describe, for example.
The butler did it.
Yeah, that's what I would describe as patterns of genre. And in fact, for me, I mean, interestingly enough, the word genre appeared in almost every other page of the 5 to 14 literacy documentation, this word genre. And of course, many people weren't really that sure what it meant. And many more people were not at all that sure how to actually teach it to kids. How do you get the kids to understand the notion of genre? Well, I would approach it from the other end and develop reading and have people reading so much that they start to understand patterns, and particularly the patterns of genre. So that was recognizing patterns. Where was I?
It was either five or six.
That was four, was it? Yeah, making predictions, that, asking questions.
It was five or six. Questions. I had a hand unfolded patterns. The time you got to there.
Right. Summarising is another one. Summarising, making summaries as you go. I mean, as you read any text, and I mean any text, whether it's a printed text or a film text or any other text, one of the things you do as a sophisticated reader is you're making a summary of what you have just read. And you're changing that summary, if you like, and revising that summary as you go, according to what comes next, in a sense. And the final one is the evaluation one, which is the one we started with, Steve. Yeah. Notion of developing. The notion of, if you like, helping kids or developing readers to work out how to evaluate a text properly. We all evaluate text. Every time we engage with text, we evaluate it. But some, you know, often we don't get beyond the "that was great" or "that was awful" kind of evaluation based on whatever happens to be in your head. But actually to be developing criteria for evaluation along the lines of what was the creator's intention, what was the author's intention here, or what was the filmmaker's intention, what were they trying to do, to what extent did they succeed, and what was the audience, who was it meant for, what was the purpose of it, what were the messages of it, to what extent did it succeed, and if you were to compare it with other similar texts, how good or how successful, I'm not too keen on the word good, how successful was it in relation to other similar texts? Because after all, if you think of reading as engaging with texts, as Paul G, the American literacy expert, said, we don't ever just read or write, we always read or write something.
Yeah.
So whatever these texts are we only really can compare them with other texts. And that's where your evaluative criteria have to come from.
Yeah, so it moves beyond just emotivism. Well, it was good because I liked it.
Yeah, I kind of got reaction, yeah. If you like.
Yeah, okay. Well, that sounds very much like... Go on, sorry.
I mean, that's just that's a whistle stop tour of the seven strategies. I mean, there's so much within each of the strategies that I can
if I could just briefly mention, Steve, you've reminded me of something. I used to do some work with A-level students, particularly a couple of groups in the area of the Wirral. And I remember trying to summarise a similar approach, quite different, but similar in some ways, to critical thinking. So I used to teach a lot of thinking skills.
Yeah, yeah.
And just when it came to literature itself now, by which I meant, you know, newspaper, magazines, you know, at that point the internet wasn't an advanced animal it is now, but, you know, any texts at all. There was a way of coming at that which used what I used to describe as strands and frames, or frames and strands. The idea being that there were two main things to consider as you did your critical analysis, and it worked both ways. It could also be, you know, to consider as you presented a critical case or examination or even argument, and the frames were to spend time thinking, you know, what are the frames that the author here is seeing the world through? You know, is it a left-wing article, a right-wing article? Is it a neutral, clear glass frame sort of thing? Or is it biased in a particular way? You know, is the article written by the, you know, maternity group of America or something? And therefore, what frames are they seeing things through? And the second thing to then consider, once you'd got the broad frames of the piece and checked whether, you know, whether you'd been biased yourself in identifying those frames, and could you find evidence in it that, you know, that it was true to the frame or the genre, if you like, of literature. Try and make a couple of connections. You then looked at the strands. You would pick out the different strands of the argument and check whether they were fully followed through, and see just how rich it was as an argument. Had the person or the people writing it just fixated, in other words, on one or two things that they thought made a strong case. But if you could then find other strands that had been untouched by the argument, then it would weaken it in your analysis, or weaken your own presentation if you were doing it yourself. I used to find that a really useful tool. I just saw lots of parallels there in what you were just doing.
Yeah, I think too, Matthew.
Some paperwork of that, if I've even got it anywhere
now. Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I'm of the view, just from the evidence I see around about me, not from any particular academic study, but just from the evidence I see around about me of the sort of pervasiveness, if you like, of electronic and digital media nowadays, that most people's reading, I guess, is probably not done on paper anymore, but done from screens, from various sources. And I actually think that the media studies at a basic level and is now literacy, and literacy is now media studies at a basic level. I don't mean sort of media studies at an academic level, but at a very basic level, I think media studies and literacy are pretty much the same thing now, because it is about, I think, an understand. It's about understanding media, and it's about creating media.
Which comes back to what Steve asked about the iPads and tablet devices earlier.
Yeah. No, some things. It was interesting. What I was going to say earlier was, it seems there's kind of long strands going through this conversation. Ancient strand, you know, it's a very kind of Socratic process, what you're describing, and what Matthew was describing.
We set out to be Socratic, Steve. I mean, I hope you don't.
Of course.
Think
yeah.
No, absolutely. No. of course. I will leave that thought. I was going to tread into dangerous into territory we said we wouldn't tread into. So
you actually
reminded me, Steve, of another fascinating book I read not that long ago about the use of Socratic circles in teaching and in schools. I don't know whether you're familiar with the idea of Socratic circles. I know you're familiar with the idea of Socratic discourse, but are you familiar with the idea of Socratic circles?
Well, yeah, I've come across it in the philosophy of the children movement.
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah. Which I think, I just find it quite a fascinating notion. And it's one of the great things about it for me is it's about children learning about a topic. Collectively, if you like, it's about helping each other towards a better understanding of a topic, which for me is really what education is about.
Yeah. Right, I'll tell you what I'm going to do here. Matthew, have you got, because we did want to draw on some of Bill's latest work, didn't we, towards the end of this program. So, Matthew, have you got a quick item that you want to bring forward before we do that?
No, but the time as it is, there's nothing important enough that would want to keep us away from the wisdom of Bill.
So,
straight face there, Bill. Good man.
I've lost Bill's video at this point. It's just like a white cutout.
I am a white cutout.
white profile. the little bubble coming up. So we've had seven reading strategies. We've now got 10. What do we say?
Well, this is the Alfie Kohn thing. Do you want me to have?
Yeah.
I mean, if you were to ever indulge me again, I could enjoy this
while it lasts.
I could talk at great length about each of the seven reading strategies, but Alfie Kohn's much more interesting. So I'll mention this article which was going around on Twitter last week and causing quite a bit of debate, as you might expect. But it's from the Washington Post. It's Alfie Kohn. For those of you who don't know Alfie Kohn, he's the guy who's written such things as The Homework Myth, Why Our Children Get Too Much of a Bad Thing.
My girlfriend's just read that, and she's been very influenced by it. At the moment, I'm about a third of the way through, and I haven't gone back to it. I didn't find it a very engaging book, but I did love his previous one, Punished by Rewards.
Punished by Rewards, yeah. And another one is No Contest, A Case Against Competition, which I have to say is one of my favourite themes, you know, the notion that I often wonder to myself when education became such a competition of individuals against each other. Maybe it's always been like that, but when you think about it, learning is a competitive thing, or is it a collective collaborative effort that I prefer?
It's hard to know, because since we turned schools into the factory model, then we've had class comparisons, and how could it be another than that?
I
certainly came through a school system whereby if you sharing anything with your neighbour was copying or cheating.
Yeah, I mean, there must be elements of learning which, you know, if you take learning philosophically, there must be elements of which competition will advance learning. But you only do that in a collective. You can only be competitive within a collective, can't you? You're not generally. I mean, you can be competitive. You can be competitive with yourself in terms of setting self challenges. But
yeah, right.
But even the notion of competition needs a collective context.
Yeah.
Mm. Fair comment, I think, Steve. Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, this Alfie Kohn, what Alfie Kohn seems to be suggesting here, that he says, do we really need education policies and practices to cover everything that goes on in the classroom? No is his answer. He says, all we need are some guidelines. So he offers 12 of these guidelines. I'll just throw one or two at you and see what you think.
Oh, we've got 19 now. this is the podcast where learning grows.
We wouldn't necessarily have to cover them all, but just for example, of his 12 guidelines, the first one is learning should be organized around problems, projects, and (students) (questions), not around lists of facts or skills or separate disciplines. Controversial. The second one is thinking is messy. Deep thinking is really messy. Therefore, beware prescriptive standards and outcomes that are too specific and orderly.
A quote, I believe, often attributed to David Perkins.
Is that right?
I believe so. I may be wrong.
Yeah, you could be right. The third one is... The third one is the primary criterion for what we do in schools. How will this affect kids' interest? And that's in italics there, for presumably emphasised. How will this affect kids' interest in the topic and their excitement about learning more generally? And the fourth one is, if students are off task, in inverted commas, the problem may be with the task, not with the kids.
Yeah, I think once you've given them a good beating and that you've told them that they don't get out until the task is over, you may start to suspect the task.
The task is the problem.
That's what Alfie Cohen probably intended in that.
But even if you, I mean, even if you look at the first of his guidelines there, I mean, so much subject for discussion there. Learning should be organised around problems, projects, and students' questions. Yeah. Not a particularly new idea or unique idea, but not around list of facts or skills. We don't want to go down the road of talking about Michael Gove again, as you say.
I've been
so self-disciplined.
He's been totally restrained.
Yeah. But as he also says there, Cohen, it should not be organised around lists of facts or skills or separate disciplines. And that's a conversation I've had any number of times with colleagues about the secondary structures in our schools, and I've got myself into bits of trouble with it before, and people violently disagreeing with me about that.
I think that's one of those kind of what you might call essentially contested concepts that we will never, you know, the notion of a discipline. I mean, some people have argued that as a kind of, there is a logical basis that is universal for basing these disciplines. Other people say, well, you know, these things change over time, and so there's no fixed points for basing a curriculum upon discipline. I'll just come back to that notion about the facts and knowledge, because I mean it's a huge controversy in the States at the moment, and some of it spilled over here. You know, the whole thing about E.D. Hirsch and his 5,000 essential facts, you know, which every child needs to learn. You know, and it's caused huge controversy in the States. It's obviously going to be a big controversy over here as well. And I guess, you know, the aforementioned person who I'm not going to name, he who shall be nameless has slagged off the curriculum for excellence, isn't he, on the
rhymes
with
love.
The Voldemort of education.
Yeah. On the basis of it,
he who has no name.
Yeah.
So. Well, I suppose related to that, you've got something which sort of I was aware of throughout my schooling and my teaching career, and that was the notion of a canon of literature. You know that there are certain literary texts which every young person, or every person for that matter, should have read by the time they die. I have to be perfectly honest here and say I'm not entirely sure where I stand on that issue myself. I mean, if you ask me in different days, I'd probably give you different answers.
Yeah, but you see, that's an interesting one, because if you ask people now, I mean, about the curriculum, they probably say, well, Shakespeare's got to be on there, right? But Shakespeare wasn't actually studied in English schools until very late in the 19th century, because actually Shakespeare and the classics, literature, the so-called classics, were things that, you know, the well-to-do or the educated would be deemed to have studied in their own time. You know, so the fact that actually Shakespeare, you know, if you look at these things historically, the fact that people might say, oh, yeah, Shakespeare's always been a classic kind of canon, you know, it's a canon of it. Well, it hasn't. You know, it's several hundred years after his first publication.
Although
when he became
an odd example there, Steve, because Shakespeare himself wasn't studied as the, you know, part of the canon. But when you think about it, all Shakespeare did was codify in what I presume is a beautiful language stories from the canon. You know, like Henry VIII, Romeo and Juliet. You know, he simply encapsulated. Sure. It's like, you know, Walter Scott or whatever. He simply took many of the folk tales and things that were around and turned
and reworked them.
Although
a significant number of the stories that Shakespeare retold in a sense were pretty sort of remote, obscure stories, and we'll probably never have seen the light of day. I mean, Romeo and Juliet, for example, coming from a kind of fairly obscure Italian poem translated to English, then picked up by Shakespeare, and then etc. etc.
Although, as a great fan of folk song, I would have to say that all he did was expanded on one of those genre pieces, which is just the, you know, you're from the wrong side of the tracks.
Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
and that's been common in all literature, really, hasn't it?
Yes, it's interesting, the conversation, because I met a good friend of mine this morning for a coffee, and we were chatting about various things, including what we were each watching by way of television series and box sets and so on, and he was saying that he's in the middle of watching The Sopranos at the moment, which I haven't seen, but my son gave me the box set last week, so I'm planning to watch it soon.
Sure, I can really stand opera myself.
But he was talking about this,
like the tenor of your joke there, mate.
Come on.
Sorry. Ari, are you offended?
Right.
I'm just going to sit back here and enjoy this.
No, Bill, carry on, please.
I'm going to be contra-punted from the cast now.
Yeah.
With these ostinatotious lines.
No, Bill, right, please, carry on. Oh, yeah. Quick.
It gets worse.
No, he does. Yeah, we won't encourage him. No,
I've been very moderate for about 50 episodes in a row. I consciously tried to stop that. Welcome back, and it's all gone. You're a bad influence.
It's all gone. Absolutely. Falling apart. My friend Jim was talking about the early episodes of The Sopranos, and I said to him, "Oh, this sounds like Shakespeare reworked for a modern day audience." Again, it's a bit of a cliche, but everything in life is in Shakespeare. And part of me thinks, you know, for somebody to go through life without ever experiencing Shakespeare, either reading it or hearing it or seeing it, even better, would be a bit of a shame, really. But then again, is that just a kind of sort of selfish, elitist?
Just advance the thought that we might be edging towards, which is that it doesn't matter whether Shakespeare is accepted as part of a good canon. It's just that if you're going to be part of being, you know, a social animal, enjoying and understanding literature, you need a canon. You know, that there's a chance that if you and I meet, Bill, and have a coffee, it doesn't matter if we know the same 200 books, but that we've got some overlap somewhere that we can touch base and connect and share understanding with.
We understand the concept of a book,
but I also think, I mean, Bill raises a really interesting point with this discussion, and you know that there has to be you do have to make an evaluative judgment. You know, we use normative judgments such as good or worthy or quality or whatever, and I think we should say a piece of literature or art, you know, that has a quality of some sort. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think that kind of a knowledge, and I think in some respects, you know, we don't do young people any favours if, as you say, if they're missing out on. Surely that, you know, our education is about a conversation with what we deem to be worthy of conversing about with the next generation.
Yeah. Absolutely, Steve. And I agree with you entirely. I think the point I'm making about the need to, if you like, raise awareness of the process of evaluation is that we, as educators, I think, need to be clear about why we think, for example, Shakespeare is quality literature, and be more explicit about that. Because I think we've been guilty in the past of sort of having these texts, if you like, as part of the curriculum, on the understanding on our part that they are the quality texts, but without actually fully explaining sometimes why we think they are the quality texts. It's just accepted that they are.
Is it possible that while we're getting into this mire here, this muck of the subjective, that we've forgotten what the point of the Alfie Cohen list was?
Oh yes,
oh yes.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch.
meanwhile, Meanwhile, back at the Alfie Cohen list, let me just throw some more of these statements at you, just for the hell of it. And I'm sure the listeners, if they haven't fallen asleep, if they haven't fallen asleep by this stage, might actually reflect on
Yeah, Joyce, wake up.
Joyce, wake up. He goes on, in outstanding classrooms, teachers do more listening than talking, mm-hmm. and students do more talking than listening. Mm-hmm. Wow. Six, children learn how to make good decisions by making decisions, not by following directions.
Excellent.
Wow. When we aren't sure how to solve a problem relating to curriculum, pedagogy or classroom conflict, the best response is often to ask the kids. Mm-hmm. The more focused we are on kids' behaviours, in inverted commas, the more we end up missing the kids themselves, mm-hmm. along with the needs, motives and reasons that underlie their actions. If students are rewarded or praised for doing something, for example, reading, solving problems, being kind, they'll likely lose interest in whatever they had to do to get the reward. The more that students are led to focus on how well they're doing in school, the less engaged they'll tend to be with what they're doing in school. All learning can be assessed, but the most important kinds of learning are very difficult to measure, and the quality of that learning may diminish if we try to reduce it to numbers. Standardised tests assess the proficiencies that matter least. Such tests serve mostly to make unimpressive forms of instruction appear successful.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Wow. So a whole lot of statements there that really turn a whole lot of things up in their head.
Yeah.
Do you know, there's a general point here that I think we should make, and it's how important it is that we have people like Alfie Cohen. Because there aren't many people that write from that sort of semi-academic background that are as iconoclastic as he is in getting away with it.
In challenging the orthodoxies, yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, there is no sacred cow for this man. Mm. You know, simultaneously, while he's writing about punished by rewards, you know, schools were... and still are, although maybe just slightly less enthusiastically, going absolutely crazy for reward and praise schemes, as though, you know, as though it's the only game in town, without noticing their own addiction to it and the possible side effects. But Cohen didn't care; he just steams in and says it how he sees it from the, you know, from the research. You know, just when I say an iconoclast, that makes it sound as if that's his, you know, his reason for doing these things. But he's just. He is just monumentally unafraid to say what needs to be said, even if it's hard.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that strikes me about the sad thing about our contemporary education debate discourse is that he would be dismissed as a progressive educator. Therefore, we don't need to take what he's saying seriously.
One of the blob.
He would be labelled, wouldn't he? Somebody would like... You know, progressive education. Now we've done all that. Don't need to take it seriously, and we're not engaging with the arguments. You know, that's the problem, isn't it? Apart from an inside learning.
Yeah. Well, he was. When I picked up this link on Twitter last week. I mean, he was being dismissed as a progressive nutcase by some of the people I follow on Twitter. So you're right. You're absolutely right, Steve.
Yeah. So I'm thinking here that there's some of these things. I mean, like the thing about the argument about the canon and quality and relative cultural relativity and so on. That sounds like another program coming on here, Bill.
Why don't we just pick this one up next week? Because was it 12 things that Cohen said there?
That was a list of 12, yeah. I can send you the link, obviously.
Yeah.
Printed and put up my wall. You know, it's just fascinating stuff. I can see arguments for and against some of them, but they all feel like good medicine that would, you know, that would get me moving.
Absolutely.
What a lovely image.
Yeah. That's another metaphor we don't wish to pursue, listeners. Yeah, no, I think that's a really good. I mean, a really good idea, because we want to do justice to one or two of these things, discussing them in full, don't we?
Plus, you and I felt, Steve, for a few weeks there, although we thoroughly have been enjoying ourselves and we've not been ignoring it, we wanted to focus a wee bit more on pedagogical and sort of classroom issues for a little while. So, Bill, you've obviously given us just the right impetus for at least a little while.
Well. impetus and medicine.
So I'm going to do my cherry thing.
Sure, it's a word. Must be a word.
And so I think probably we've come to the end of our time here, reasonable time anyway. Although we could talk for hours longer, I know. So, Bill, are you up for coming back next week?
Is sadly, this... though, much ado about nothing.
Oh.
But fortunately, no tempest.
Oh, dear. Sorry, Steve.
Right, it's all right now. We'll still be here on the 12th night discussing this, aren't we? All right.
And you said you were doing the cherry thing. You can't let the tumbleweed come in. We can't have dead air.
No, sorry, doing a corpse. Yeah, Bill. Sorry, what the question was? Are you available for next week?
Do you want to pursue this with me? I mean, feel free to pursue the Alfie Con points without me if you'd prefer.
No. I think I've thoroughly enjoyed tonight's conversation. I think it's worth pursuing if that's.
Well, if your listeners could stand it, I'd be quite happy to come back and talk about them some more. Yeah. Well,
what do you think, Matthew? Fantastic. I think we should do that.
Oh no, absolutely, and I'll be thinking about them all week. Well, we put up the link though to the 12 things this week anyway, so that the listeners can.
Yeah.
And get their teeth into them.
And if people have any thoughts about that, they'd just like to email or tweet us with that we can bring into the program, that would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it looks like we've got ourselves a good program next week. So it just remains
folks for this week.
Try harder next week.
Incidentally, I think we might be on to record lengths of time, Steve.
I know. We've just done over the hour, haven't we?
Significantly.
Not significantly.
Oh, no, you're right. Sorry, I'm looking at the length of the call. Steve, I humbly beg your pardon.
Thank you very much.
There are more clocks than are dreamt of in your philosophy, Matthew.
Right. Good night, folks. It's been great talking to you, Bill.
Good night.
And likewise. Cheers. Good night, guys.